Leviathan, Part 2, Commonwealth, by Thomas Hobbes. First published in 1651. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 20 and 21. Chapter 20, Paternal Dominion and Despotic Dominion. A commonwealth by acquisition is one where the sovereign power is acquired by force. And it is acquired by force when men, either singly or jointly by majority of voices, are led by their fear of death or imprisonment to authorize all the actions of the man or assembly that has their lives and liberty in his or its power. This kind of dominion or sovereignty differs from sovereignty by institution only in this. Men who choose their sovereign do it for fear of one another, not fear of the man whom they institute. But in this case of dominion by acquisition, they are afraid of the very person whom they institute as sovereign. In both cases, they act out of fear, a fact that should be noted by those who hold that any covenant is void if it comes from fear of death or violence. If they were right, no man in any kind of commonwealth could be obliged to obedience. It's true that when a commonwealth has been instituted or acquired, promises coming from fear of death or violence are not covenants, and don't oblige if the thing promised is contrary to the laws. But that's not because the promise is made out of fear, but because the promiser has no right to do what he has promised to do. The rights and consequences of sovereignty are the same in both instituted and acquired sovereignty. The monarch's power can't, without his consent, be transferred to someone else. He can't forfeit it. He can't be accused by any of his subjects of having wronged them. He can't be punished by them. He is the judge of what is necessary for peace, and the judge of what doctrines may be published. He is the sole legislator, supreme arbitrator of controversies, and supreme judge of the times and occasions for war and peace. It is for him to choose magistrates, counsellors, commanders, and all other officers and ministers, and to determine all rewards and punishments, honours and rankings. The reasons for this in sovereignty by acquisition are the ones I gave in Chapter 18 for the same rights and consequences of sovereignty by institution. Dominion is acquired two ways, by generation and by conquest. The right of dominion by generation is what the parent has over his children and is called paternal. It doesn't come from the mere fact of generation, as though the parent had dominion over his child simply because he begot him. Rather, it comes from the child's consent, either explicitly stated or indicated by other sufficient signs. As for the idea that generation alone is enough for dominion, God has given to man a woman as helper, and there are always two who are equally parents. So the dominion over the child, if it came from generation alone, would belong equally to both parents, and the child would be subject to both equally, which is impossible, for no man can obey two masters. And whereas some, such as Aristotle and Aquinas, have ascribed the dominion to the man only, because the male sex is the more excellent one, they have miscalculated. For there is not always enough difference of strength or prudence between men and women for the right to be determined peacefully. In commonwealths, this controversy is decided by the civil law, and usually, though not always, the judgment goes in favour of the father, because most commonwealths have been set up by the fathers of families, not the mothers. But the present question concerns the state of mere nature, where we can't assume laws of matrimony, or laws for the upbringing of children, but only the law of nature and the natural fondness of the sexes for one another and for their children. In this raw condition of nature, either the parents settle the dominion over the child jointly, by contract, or they don't settle it at all. If they do, the right goes where the contract says it goes. We find in history that the Amazons contracted with the men of the neighbouring countries to whom they went to have children, that the male children should be sent back to their fathers, but the female ones would remain with themselves, so that in their case the dominion of the females was in the mother. If there's no contract, the mother has dominion. For in the condition of mere nature, it can't be known who is the father, unless the mother declares it. So the right of dominion over the child depends on her will, that is, on her choice not to say who the father is, which means that the dominion is hers. Also, the infant is at first in the power of the mother, so that she can either nourish it or expose it, that is, leave it out in the open to die, unless rescued by strangers. If she nourishes it, the child owes its life to the mother, and is therefore obliged to obey her rather than anyone else, and consequently the dominion over it is hers. But if she exposes the child, and another person finds and nourishes it, the dominion is in that person. For the child ought to obey the man who has preserved it, because preservation of life is the purpose for which one human becomes subject to another, so that every man is supposed to promise obedience to the person who has it in his power to save him or destroy him. If the mother is a subject of the father, the child is in the father's power. And if the father is a subject of the mother, as when a sovereign queen marries one of her subjects, the child is subject to the mother, because the father also is her subject. If a man and a woman, who are monarchs of two different kingdoms, have a child, and make a contract concerning who shall have dominion of him, the right of dominion goes where the contract puts it. If they don't make a contract, the dominion follows the dominion of the place of the child's residence, for the sovereign of each country has dominion over all who live in it. He who has dominion over a child has dominion also over the child's children, and over their children's children. For he who has dominion over the person of a man has dominion over all that is his. Without that, dominion would be just a title, with no effect. The right of succession to paternal dominion proceeds in the same way as the right of succession to monarchy, about which I have already said enough in Chapter 19. Dominion acquired by conquest, or victory in war, is what some writers call despotic, from despotes, a Greek word meaning lord or master, and is the dominion of a master over his servant. This dominion is acquired by the victor when the vanquished, seeking to avoid being killed on the spot, covenants explicitly or otherwise that as long as his life and the liberty of his body are allowed to him, the victor will have the use of them at his pleasure. After such a covenant is made, the vanquished person is a servant, not before. The word servant does not mean captive, a status that doesn't involve any covenant. A captive is someone kept in prison, or in fetters, until the owner of the man who captured him, or who bought him from someone who captured him, has decided what to do with him. Such men, commonly called slaves, have no obligation at all, but may justly break their bonds, or smash the prison, and kill their master, or carry him away as a captive. A servant's situation is nothing like this. A servant is someone who, having been captured, is allowed bodily liberty, and is trusted by his master on the strength of his promise not to run away or do violence to his master. So it's not the victory that gives the victor a right of dominion over the vanquished, but the covenant between them. What puts the vanquished man under an obligation is not his being conquered, that is, defeated and either captured or put to flight, but his coming in and submitting to the victor and making with him the covenant I have described. And the mere fact that the vanquished man surrenders, without being promised his life, does not oblige the victor to spare him. When the vanquished man yields himself to the victor's discretion, this obliges the victor for only as long as he thinks fit. What men do in asking for quarter, as it is now called, is to evade the present fury of the victor by submission, and to offer ransom or service in exchange for their life. So someone who receives quarter hasn't been given his life. the status of his life is merely deferred until further deliberation by the victor. For in asking for quarter, he wasn't yielding on condition of being allowed his life, but merely yielding to the victor's discretion. When the victor has entrusted him with his bodily liberty, then his life is something he keeps on certain conditions, and his service is something he owes, then, but not before. For slaves who work in prisons or in chains don't owe their service. They serve not out of duty, but to avoid the cruelty of their taskmasters. The master of the servant is master also of everything the servant has, and may demand the use of it, that is, the use of the servant's goods, of his labour, of his servants, and of his children, as often as he thinks fit. For what enables the servant to stay alive, rather than being killed by his master, is the covenant of obedience through which he owns and authorizes everything the master does. And if he refuses to serve, and his master kills or imprisons or otherwise punishes him for his disobedience, the servant is himself the author of this action, and can't accuse his master of wronging him. Summing up, the rights and consequences of both paternal and despotic dominion are the very same as those of a sovereign by institution, and for the same reasons, which I have set out in chapter 18. Suppose, then, that a man is monarch of two nations, having sovereignty in one by institution of the assembled people, and in the other by conquest, that is, by the submission of each individual person to avoid death or imprisonment. To demand more from the conquered nation than from the one with the commonwealth by institution, simply because the former was conquered, is an act of ignorance of the rights of sovereignty. For the sovereign is absolute over both nations alike, or else there's no sovereignty at all, and every man may lawfully protect himself if he can, with his own sword, which is the condition of war. From this it appears that a great family, if it isn't part of some commonwealth, is in itself a little monarchy, in which there are rights of sovereignty, the sovereign being the master or father. This holds whether the family consists of a man and his children, of a man and his servants, or of a man and his children and servants together. But a family isn't properly a commonwealth unless it has enough power, through its numbers or its situation, to avoid being subdued without the risk of starting a war. For when a number of men are plainly too weak to mount a united defence by themselves, each of them may, in time of danger, use his own reason to save his life, either by flight or by submission to the enemy, as he thinks best. Just as a squad of soldiers, when a whole army takes them by surprise, may throw down their arms and ask for quarter, or run away rather than being put to the sword. That brings me to the end of what I have to say about sovereign rights, on the basis of theorizing and deduction concerning the nature, needs, and designs of men, when they establish commonwealths, and put themselves under monarchs or assemblies which they entrust with enough power for their protection. So that it appears plainly to my understanding that the sovereign power is as great as men can possibly be imagined to make it, whether it is placed in one man, as in monarchy, or in one assembly of men, as in democratic and aristocratic commonwealths. And though men may fancy many evil consequences from such unlimited power, the consequences of not having it, namely, perpetual war of every man against his neighbour, are much worse. The condition of men in this life will never be without disadvantages, but the only big disadvantages that occur in any commonwealth come from the subject's disobedience and breaking of the covenants that brought the commonwealth into existence. Anyway, someone who thinks that sovereign power is too great and seeks to lessen it will have to subject himself to a power that can limit it, that is, to a still greater power. The greatest objection is an argument from people's actual behaviour. It is asked, where and when have subjects actually acknowledged such power? But I ask in turn, where and when has there been a commonwealth where the power was not absolute, and yet there was no sedition and civil war? In nations whose commonwealths have been long-lived and not destroyed except by foreign war, the subjects never did dispute over the sovereign power. But anyway, you can't base any conclusions on the behaviour of men who haven't gone into things thoroughly, and accurately weighed the causes and nature of commonwealths, and who suffer daily the miseries that come from ignorance of these matters. Even if throughout the world men laid the foundations of their houses on sand, it wouldn't follow that that's what they ought to do. The making and maintaining of commonwealths isn't a mere matter of practical know-how, like tennis. It is a science, with definite and infallible rules, like arithmetic and geometry. Poor men don't have the leisure to discover these rules, and men who have had the leisure have up till now not had the curiosity to search for them or the method to discover them. Chapter 21. The Liberty of Subjects. The equivalent terms, liberty and freedom, properly understood, signify the absence of opposition, that is, absence of external impediments to motion. These terms may be applied to unthinking and inanimate creatures, just as much as to thinking ones. For when something, anything, is tied down or hemmed in so that it can move only within a certain space, this space being determined by the opposition of some external body, we say it doesn't have liberty to go further. So when any living creature is imprisoned or restrained by walls or chains, or when the water that would otherwise spread over a larger space is held back by banks or containers, we say that it's not at liberty to move in the way that it would without those barriers. But when the impediment to motion lies in the constitution of the thing itself, as when a stone lies still, or a man is held to his bed by sickness, what we say it lacks is not the liberty, but rather the power to move. And according to this proper and generally accepted meaning of the word free, a freeman is someone who isn't hindered from doing whatever he has the strength and wit to do. But when the words free and liberty are applied to anything other than bodies, they are misused. For if something isn't the sort of thing that can move, it's not the sort of thing that can be impeded. I shall give four examples of such misuses. When it is said that the path is free, liberty is attributed not to the path, but to those who walk along it. When we say the gift is free, we don't mean to attribute liberty to the gift. We are attributing it to the giver, who is not bound by any law or covenant to give it. When we say that people speak freely, we are attributing liberty not to the voice or pronunciation, but to the man, who is not obliged by any law to speak otherwise than he did. The use of the phrase free will attributes liberty not to a man's will, desire, or inclination, but to the man himself, whose liberty consists in his not being blocked from doing what he has the will, desire, or inclination to do. Liberty is consistent with fear. When a man throws his goods into the sea for fear the ship should sink, he does it very willingly, and can refuse to do it if he so desires. So it is the action of someone who is free. Sometimes a man pays a debt only out of fear of imprisonment, but because nobody prevented him from keeping the money, paying it was the action of a man at liberty. Quite generally, all the things that men do in commonwealths, out of fear of the law, are actions which the doers were free to omit, and so they were actions freely performed. Liberty is consistent with necessity. Water has not only the liberty but the necessity of flowing down the channel. The same holds for the actions that men voluntarily do, because they come from the men's will. They come from liberty, and yet they also come from necessity, because every act of man's will and every desire and inclination comes from some cause, which comes from another cause, and so on, backwards, in a continual chain whose first link is in the hand of God, the first of all causes. So that to someone who could see the connection of all those causes, the necessity of all men's voluntary actions would seem obvious. And therefore God, who sees and arranges everything, sees that a man's liberty is doing what he wills, is accompanied by the necessity of doing exactly what God wills, no more and no less. For though men may do many things of which God is not the author, because they are contrary to his laws, they have no passion, will, or appetite, whose first and full cause is not from God's will. If God's will did not assure the necessity of man's will, and, therefore, of everything that depends on man's will, the liberty of men would conflict with and impede the omnipotence and liberty of God. And that's enough for present purposes about natural liberty, which is the only liberty properly so called. But just as men have pursued peace and their own survival by making an artificial man, which we call a commonwealth, so also they have made artificial chains, called civil laws, which they have by mutual covenants fastened at one end to the lips of the man or assembly to whom they have given the sovereign power, and at the other end to their own ears. These bonds are in themselves weak, but they can be made to hold not by the difficulty, but by the danger of breaking them. The liberty of subjects, my next topic, is to be understood purely in relation to these bonds. In no commonwealth in the world are there stated rules that regulate all the actions and words of men. Indeed, there couldn't be such rules. From this it follows necessarily that in all kinds of actions on which the laws are silent, men have the liberty of doing what their own reasons suggest as most profitable to themselves. For if we take liberty in its proper sense of bodily liberty, that is, freedom from chains and prison, it would be very absurd for men to clamour, as they do, for the liberty that they so obviously enjoy. And if we take liberty to be exemption from all laws, it is no less absurd for a man to demand liberty, as some do, when that liberty, involving the absence of all laws, would enable all other men to be masters of his life. Yet this absurdity is what some people demand, not realizing that the laws have no power to protect them, unless a sword in the hands of some man or assembly of men causes the laws to be obeyed. So the liberty of a subject lies only in the things that the sovereign passes over in regulating their conduct, such as the liberty to buy and sell, and otherwise contract with one another, to choose their own home, and diet, and trade, to educate their children as they think fit, and the like. But we're not to infer that the subject's having such liberty abolishes or limits the sovereign power over life and death. For I have already shown in chapter 18 that he who has the supreme power, that is, the sovereign representative of the commonwealth, can't wrong his citizens, even though he can by his wickedness do wrong to God. So it can and often does happen in commonwealths that a subject is put to death by the command of the sovereign power, without either of them having wronged the other, as when Jephthah caused his daughter to be sacrificed. To thank God for his victory over the Ammonites, the book of Judges reports, "Jephthah vowed that whoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to greet me, I will offer up for a burnt offering." And behold, his daughter came out to greet him. Her father did with her according to his vow. This was a case where the person who died was free to perform the action for which she was put to death, and in being put to death she was not wronged. And the same holds true when a sovereign prince puts to death an innocent subject, as David did to Uriah, whose wife he was attracted to. For although the action is against the law of nature, as being contrary to equity, it was a wronging not of Uriah, but of God. Not of Uriah, because Uriah had covenanted to be a subject, thus giving David the right to do what he pleased, but of God, because David was God's subject and was prohibited from all wickedness by the law of nature. David himself evidently confirmed this distinction when he repented of his action and said to God, "To thee only have I sinned." Similarly, when the Athenian people sent a citizen into exile by ostracism, it did not accuse him of a crime, but exiled whomever a majority of citizens wished to exile, not because he had violated the laws, but because he seemed so powerful that he could violate them and get away with it. So they banished Aristides, to whom they had previously given the name the Just. They likewise banished Hyperbolus, a scurrilous jester, whom nobody feared, because they wanted to. Perhaps they did it as a joke. But this wasn't unjust, because they banished him by the right of the Commonwealth. The liberty so frequently mentioned and honoured in the histories and philosophy of the ancient Greeks and Romans, and in the writings and discourse of those whose knowledge of politics comes solely from them, is the liberty not of particular men, but of the Commonwealth. If each individual man had that liberty, there would be no civil laws and no Commonwealth at all, and the effects would be the same for individuals as it is for states. Among masterless men, there is perpetual war of every man against his neighbour, with every individual man having full and absolute liberty. No inheritance to transmit to the son, or to expect from the father, no ownership of goods or lands, no security. Similarly, with states and commonwealths that don't depend on one another, every commonwealth, not every man, has an absolute liberty to do what it judges to be most conducive to its benefit. That is, what is so judged by the man or assembly that represents it. But along with their freedom, they live in a condition of perpetual war, and at the edges of battlegrounds, with the frontiers armed and cannons planted against their surrounding neighbours. The Athenians and Romans were free, that is, they were free commonwealths. It wasn't that individual men had the liberty to resist their own representative, but that their representative had the liberty to resist or invade other people. The word libertas is written in large letters on the turrets of the city of Lucca even now. But this doesn't imply that individual men there have more liberty, or more immunity from service to the Commonwealth, than men do in Constantinople. Whether a Commonwealth is monarchic or democratic, the freedom is still the same. But it is easy for men to be deceived by the glittering word liberty, and, lacking skill in making distinctions, to think they have as a private inheritance and birthright something that is really the right only of the public, the Commonwealth. And when the same mistake is supported by the authority of men renowned for their writings on this subject, it's no wonder that it leads to sedition and change of government. In these western parts of the world, we are made to receive our opinions about the institution and rights of commonwealths from Aristotle, Cicero, and other Greeks and Romans. These writers didn't derive the rights of commonwealths from the principles of nature. Instead, they wrote them into their books out of the practice of their own commonwealths, which were democratic, in the way grammarians based the rules of language on the practice of their time, or the rules of poetry on the poems of Homer and Virgil. The Athenians were taught, to keep them from wanting to change their government, that they were free men, and that all who lived under a monarchy were slaves. So that's what Aristotle says in his Politics. In a democracy, liberty is to be supposed, for it is commonly held that no man is free in any other form of government. Similarly, Cicero and other writers have based their theory of civil government on the opinions of the Romans, who were taught to hate monarchy, first by those who deposed their sovereign and shared amongst them the sovereignty of Rome, and afterwards by their successors. And from reading these Greek and Latin authors, men from their childhood have acquired a habit, under the false slogan of liberty, of favouring uproars, lawlessly controlling the actions of their sovereigns, and then controlling those controllers, with so much blood being spilt that I think I can truly say that highest price ever paid for anything is the price these Western lands have paid for learning the Greek and Latin tongues. We come now to details concerning the true liberty of a subject, that is, the question of what a subject may, without injustice, refuse to do when commanded to do them by the sovereign. To grasp the answer to this, we must consider what rights we relinquish when we make a commonwealth, or, the same thing, what liberty we deny ourselves by owning all the actions, all without exception, of the man or assembly we make our sovereign. For our obligation to obey and our liberty not to obey both reside in our act of submission. So the extent of each must be inferred from the act of submission, because no man has any obligation that doesn't arise from some act of his own, for all men are by nature free. Such inferences must rely either on the explicit words, "I authorize all his actions," or on his intention in submitting himself to the sovereign's power, which intention is to be understood from the purpose for which he submits. So the obligation and the liberty of the subject are to be derived from those words or others equivalent to them, or else from the purpose of the institution of sovereignty, which is the peace of the subjects among themselves and their defence against a common enemy. First, therefore, seeing that sovereignty by institution comes about through a covenant of everyone to everyone, and that sovereignty by acquisition comes about through a covenant of the vanquished to the victor, or of the child to the parent, it is obvious that every subject has liberty in respect of anything the right to which cannot be transferred by covenant. I showed in chapter 14 that covenants not to defend one's own body are void. Therefore, if the sovereign commands a man to kill, wound, or maim himself, or not to resist those who assault him, or to abstain from the use of food, air, medicine, or anything else needed to live, that man has the liberty to disobey, even if he has been justly condemned to death. If a man is interrogated by the sovereign, or by someone acting on his behalf, concerning a crime the man has committed, he isn't bound, unless promised a pardon, to confess it, because, as I showed in chapter 14, no man can be obliged by covenant to accuse himself. Again, the subject's consent to sovereign power is contained in the words, "I authorize or take upon me all his actions," and these contain no restriction at all of his own former natural liberty. For by allowing him to kill me, I am not bound to kill myself when he orders me to do so. It is one thing to say, "Kill me, or my fellow, if you please," and another thing to say, "I will kill myself or my fellow." So it follows that no man is bound by the words themselves to kill either himself or any other man. So the obligation that a man may sometimes have to do something dangerous or dishonourable when ordered to by the sovereign depends not on the words of our submission, but on why we submit, what our submission is for. Therefore, when our refusal to obey frustrates the purpose for which the sovereignty was ordained, then there's no liberty to refuse. Otherwise, there is. Upon this ground, a man who is commanded as a soldier to fight against the enemy, even if his sovereign has the right to punish his refusal with death, may in many cases refuse without injustice. An example is when he substitutes a sufficient soldier in his place, for in this case he doesn't desert the service of the Commonwealth. And allowance should be made for natural timidity, not only of women, from whom no such dangerous duty is expected, but also of men of feminine courage. When armies fight, there's a running away on one side or on both. But when what leads the soldiers to run is not treachery but fear, they are thought to act dishonourably, but not unjustly. By the same reasoning, avoiding battle is cowardice, but not injustice. Someone who enrolls himself as a soldier, or accepts an advance on his pay, can no longer plead the excuse of a timorous nature. He is obliged not only to go into battle, but also not to run from it without his captain's permission. And when the defence of the Commonwealth requires the simultaneous help of all citizens, each person who can either bear arms or contribute something to victory is obliged to undertake military service, because otherwise it was pointless for them to institute Commonwealth, one that they haven't the purpose or courage to preserve. No man has liberty to resist the sword of the Commonwealth in defence of another man, whether guilty or innocent, because such a liberty would detract from the sovereign's means for protecting us, and would therefore be destructive of the very essence of government. But if a great many men have unjustly resisted the sovereign power, or committed some capital crime for which each expects death, do they have the liberty to join together and assist and defend one another? Certainly they have, for they are only defending their lives, which the guilty man is as entitled to do as the innocent. There was, indeed, injustice in their first breach of duty, but their bearing of arms subsequent to it, although it is to maintain what they have unjustly done, is not a further unjust act. And if it is only to defend their own persons, it's not unjust at all. For this plea of self-defence is not available if the perpetrators have been given an offer of pardon, which makes it unlawful for them to persevere in helping or defending one another. All other liberties depend on the silence of the law. A subject is at liberty to do something or not do it, as he pleases, if the sovereign hasn't prescribed any rule regarding actions of that kind. This kind of liberty, therefore, is greater at some places or times than at others, depending on what the sovereign at each time and place thinks most appropriate. For example, there was a time when in England a man might by force go onto his own land and dispossess anyone who had wrongfully taken it over. But in later years, that liberty of forcible entry was taken away by a law made by the king in Parliament. Another example: in some places in the world, men are free to have many wives. In other places, they have no such liberty. If a sovereign takes anything from a subject, or requires the subject to do something, basing this on an already existing law, the subject can oppose this before judges appointed by the sovereign. For the sovereign bases his demands on the force of an existing law, and not on his power as sovereign, implying that he is demanding only what that law says is required from the subject. So the subject's suit isn't contrary to the will of the sovereign, and consequently the subject is free to demand that his case be heard, and judgment given according to that law. But if the sovereign demands or takes anything on the basis of his claim to power, there is no basis for legal action. For in such a case, what the sovereign does by virtue of his power is done by the authority of every subject. So someone who brought a legal action against the sovereign would be bringing it against himself. If a monarch grants a liberty to some or all of his subjects, where the result of this would be that he can no longer provide for their safety, the grant is void unless he explicitly renounces the sovereignty or transfers it to someone else. An explicit renunciation or transfer is required, because if he wanted to renounce or transfer, he could easily have done so in plain language. So if he didn't, it's to be understood that that is not what he wanted, and that the grant of liberty had come from his ignorance of how that liberty would conflict with the sovereign power. In such a case, therefore, the grant of liberty is void, and the sovereignty is still retained, and consequently so are all the powers necessary for the exercise of sovereignty: the power of war and peace, of judicature, of appointing officers and counsellors, of raising money, and all the rest listed in chapter 18. All of this applies equally if the sovereign is not one person but an assembly. The obligation of subjects to the sovereign is understood to last as long as he has the power to protect them, and no longer. For the right that men have by nature to protect themselves, when no one else can protect them, can't be relinquished by any covenant. The sovereignty is the soul of the commonwealth, and once it has departed from the body, the limbs no longer derive their motion from it. The purpose of obedience is protection, and wherever a man sees the prospect of protection, whether in his own sword or someone else's, nature directs his obedience to it and his endeavour to maintain it. Those who make sovereignty intend it to be immortal, but in its own nature it is not only subject to violent death by foreign war, but also contains within it, from the moment of its birth, many seeds of a natural mortality, through internal discord arising from the ignorance and passions of men. If a subject is taken prisoner in war, or his person or his means of life come under the control of the enemy, and if he has given his life and bodily liberty on condition that he becomes a subject of the victor, he has liberty to accept this condition, and then he is the subject of the victor, because he had no other way to preserve himself. But if a man is held in prison or chains, or is somehow not trusted with the liberty of his body, he can't be understood to be bound by covenant to submit, and so he may escape by any possible means. If a monarch relinquishes the sovereignty, both for himself and for his heirs, his subjects return to the unconditional liberty of nature. If he decides not to have an heir, then his action of relinquishing his sovereignty creates a situation where no one is sovereign and no one is a subject. The case is the same if he dies without known relatives and without naming an heir, for in that case no heir can be known, and so no subjection is due. A subject banished by the sovereign is not a subject during the banishment. Someone sent with a message or given leave to travel is still a subject, but what makes him so is a contract between sovereigns, not his covenant of subjection. For whoever enters into someone else's dominion is subject to all its laws, unless he has a privilege of exemption from them through friendly agreements between the sovereigns or by special license. If a monarch, who is subdued by war, makes himself subject to the victor, his subjects are released from their former obligation to him and become obliged instead to the victor. But if he is held prisoner, or in some other way doesn't have the liberty of his own body, he isn't understood to have given away the right of sovereignty, and therefore his subjects are obliged to obey the magistrates whom he previously appointed, governing not in their name, but in his. For since his right remains, the only question concerns which magistrates and officers are to act for him in his absence. And if he doesn't have a way of naming them, he is assumed to approve the ones he himself has previously appointed. End of chapter 21.